him in the neck. He'd keep his ear to the ground and go after the runaways. More than one person saw him take Charlotte. He took her? He sold her off somewhere? I was on my feet, screaming over the noise in my skull. Why didn't you look for her? He took me by the shoulders and gave me a shake. His eyes were sparkling like flint. He said, Gullah Jack and I looked for 2 days. We looked everywhere, but she was gone.
Sarah. I made the laborious journey back to Philadelphia, where I found lodging at the same house on Society Hill where Father and I had boarded earlier, expecting to stay only until the ship sailed. But on the appointed morning, my trunk packed and the carriage waiting, something strange and unknown inside of me balked. Mrs. Todd, who rented the room to me, tapped at my door. Miss Grimke, the carriage? It's waiting. May I send the driver to collect the trunk? I didn't answer immediately, but stood at the window and stared out at the leafy vine on the picket fence, at the cobble street lined with sycamore trees, the light falling in quiet, mottled patterns, and beneath my breath I whispered, No. I turned to her, untying my bonnet. It was black with a small ruffle suitable for mourning. I'd purchased it on High Street the day before, maneuvering alone in the shops with no one to please but myself, then come back to this simple room where there were no servants or slaves, no immoderate furniture or filigree or gold leaf. No one summoning me to tea with visitors I didn't care for. No expectations of any kind. Just this little room where I took care of everything myself, even spreading my own bed and seeing to my laundry. I turned to Mrs. Todd. I would like to keep the room a bit longer, if I may. She looked confused. You're not leaving as planned? No. I would like to stay a while. Only a while. I told myself it was because I wanted to grieve in private. Really, was that so implausible? Mrs. Todd was the wife of a struggling law clerk, and she clasped my hand. You're welcome to stay as long as you wish. I wrote a solicitous letter to Mother, explaining the unexplainable. Father had died, and I wasn't coming home straight away. I need to grieve alone. Mother's letter in response arrived in September. Her small, tight scrawl was thick with fury and ink. My behavior was shameful, selfish, cruel. How could you abandon me in my darkest hour? She wrote. I burned her letter in the fireplace, but her words left contusions of guilt. There was truth in what she'd written. I was selfish. I'd abandoned my mother, Nina as well. I anguished over it, but I didn't pack my trunk. I spent my days as a malingerer. I slept whenever I was tired, often in the middle of the day. Mrs. Todd gave up on my presence at appointed meals and reserved my food in the kitchen. I would take it to my room at odd hours, then wash my own dishes. There were few books to read, but I wrote in a little journal I'd bought, mostly about Father's last days, and I practiced my scripture verses with a set of Bible flashcards. I walked up and down the streets beneath the sycamores as they turned blonde, then bronze, venturing further and further each day. To Washington Square, Philosophical Hall, Old St. Mary's, and once, quite by accident, the Man Full of Trouble Tavern, where I heard shouting and crockery breaking. One Sunday, when the air was crisp and razor-cut with light, I walked ankle-deep in fallen leaves all the way to Arch Street, where I came upon a Quaker meeting house of such size I paused to stare. In Charleston we had one teeny friend's house, something of a dilapidation, to which, it was said, no one came but two cantankerous old men. As I stood there, people began to stream from the central door, the women and girls clad in dismal, excoriated dresses that made us Presbyterians seem almost flamboyant. Even the children wore drab coats and grave little faces. I observed them against the red bricks, the steepleless roof, the plain-shuttered windows, and I felt repelled. I'd heard they sat in silence, waiting for someone to utter his most inward intimacies with God out loud for everyone to hear. It sounded terrifying to me. Notwithstanding the Quakers, those days were very much like the moments I'd floated in the ocean at Long Branch beneath the white flag. A vitality inhabited those weeks, almost like a second heart beating in my chest. I'd found I could manage quite well on my own. Had it not been for Father's death, I might have been happy. When November arrived, however, I knew I couldn't remain any longer. Winter was coming. The sea would become treacherous. I packed my trunk. The ship was a cutter, which gave me hope of reaching Charleston in 10 days. I'd booked first-class passage, but my stateroom was dark and cramped, with nothing but a wall-mirror closet and a 2-foot berth. As often as possible, I hazarded above deck to feel the cold, bracing winds, huddling with the other passengers on the lee side. On the third morning, I woke near dawn and dressed quickly, not bothering to braid my hair. The stale, suffocating room felt like a sepulchre, and I surfaced above deck with my carrot hair flying, expecting to be alone. Yet there was another already at the rail. Pulling up the hood of my cloak, I sought a spot away from him. A tiny white ball of moon was still in the sky, clinging to the last bit of night. Below it a thin line of blue light ran the length of the horizon. I watched it grow. "How are thee?" a man's voice said, using the formal Quaker greeting I'd often heard in Philadelphia. As I turned to him, strands of my hair slipped from the hood and whipped wildly about my face. I'm fine, sir." He had a dramatic cleft in his chin, and piercing brown eyes, over which his brows slanted upward like the slopes of a tiny hill. He wore simple breeches, with silver knee buckles, a dark coat, and a three-cornered hat. A lock of hair, dark as coal, tossed on his forehead. I guessed him to be some years older than I, perhaps 10 or more. I'd seen him on deck before, and on the first night, in the ship's dining quarters with his wife and 8 children, 6 boys, 2 girls. I'd thought then how tired she looked. "My name is Israel Morris," he said. Later, I would wonder if the fates had placed me there. If they'd been the ones who'd kept me lingering in Philadelphia for 3 months until this particular ship sailed. Though, of course, we Presbyterians believed it was God who arranged propitious encounters like these, not mythological women with spindles, threads, and shears. The mainsails were snapping and wheezing, making a great racket. I told him my name, and then we stood for a moment, gazing at the rising brightness, at the seabirds suddenly making soaring arcs in the sky. He told me his wife, Rebecca, was quarantined in their cabin tending their youngest two, who'd become sick with dysentery. He was a broker, a commission merchant, and though he was modest, I could tell he'd been prosperous at it. In turn, I told him about the sojourn I'd made with my father and his unexpected death. The words slid fluidly off my tongue, with only an occasional stammer. I could only attribute it to the sweep and flow of water around us.
"Please accept my sympathies," he said. "It must have been difficult, caring for your father alone. Could your husband not travel with you?"
"My husband? Oh, Mr. Morris, I'm not married." His face flushed. Wanting to ease the moment, I said, "I assure you it's not a matter that concerns me much." He laughed and asked about my family, about our life in Charleston. When I told him about the house on East Bay and the plantation in the upcountry, his lively expression died away.
"You own slaves, then?"
My family does, yes.
But I myself don't condone it.
Yet you cast your lot with those who do?
I bristled. They are my family, sir. What would you have me do? He gazed at me with kindness and pity.
To remain silent in the face of evil is itself a form of evil.
I turned from him toward the glassy water. What kind of man would speak like this? A southern gentleman would as soon swallow his tongue.
Forgive my bluntness, he said. I'm a Quaker. We believe slavery to be an abomination. It's an important part of our faith.
I happen to be Presbyterian, and while we don't have an anti-slavery doctrine, like you, it's an important part of my faith as well.
Of course. My apologies. I'm afraid there's a zealot in me I'm at a loss to control.
He pulled at the rim of his hat and smiled.
I must see about breakfast for my family. I hope we might speak again, Miss Grimke. Good day.
I thought of nothing but him for the next 2 days. He disturbed nearly every waking minute, and even my sleep. I was drawn to him, in a deeper way than I'd been to Burke, and that's what frightened me. I was drawn to his brutal conscience, to his repulsive Quakerism, to the force of his ideas, the force of him. He was married, and for that I was grateful. For that, I was safe. He approached me in the dining room on the 6th day of the voyage. The ship was scudding before a gale, and we'd been banned from above deck.
May I join you? He asked.
If you like. Heat flared in my chest. I felt it travel to my cheeks, turning them to crab apples.
Are your children recovered? And your wife? Has she stayed well? The sickness is making its way through all of the children now. But they're recovering, thanks to Rebecca. We couldn't manage a single day without her. She is...
He broke off, but when I went on gazing at him expectantly, he finished his sentence.
The perfect mother.
Without his hat, he looked younger. Thatches and sprigs of black hair waved in random directions. He had tired smudges beneath his eyes, and I imagined they were from helping his wife nurse the children. But he pulled a worn leather book from his vest, saying he'd stayed up late in the night reading.
It's the Journal of John Woolman. He's a great defender of our faith.
As the conversation turned once again to Quakerism, he opened the book and read fragments to me, attempting to educate me about their beliefs.
Everyone is of equal worth, he said. Our ministers are female as well as male.
Female? I asked so many questions about this oddity he became amused.
Should I assume that female worth, like abolition, is also part of your personal faith? He said.
I have long wished for a vocation of my own.
You're a rare woman.
Some would say I'm not so much rare as radical. He smiled, and his brows lifted on his forehead, their odd tilt deepening.
Is it possible a Quaker lurks beneath that Presbyterian skin of yours?
Not at all. I told him. But later, in private, I wasn't sure. To condemn slavery was one thing. That I could do in my own individual heart. But female ministers... Throughout the few remaining days on the ship, we continued our talks in the wind-pounded world above deck, as well as the dining quarters, where it smelled of boiled rice and cigars. We discussed not only the Quakers, but theology, philosophy, and the politics of emancipation. He was of the mind that abolition should be gradual. I argued it should be immediate. He'd found an intellectual companion in me, but I couldn't completely understand why he'd befriended me. The last night aboard, Israel asked if I would come and meet his family in the dining room. His wife, Rebecca, held their youngest on her lap, a crying tot no more than three, whose red face bounced like a woodpecker against her shoulder. She was one of those slight, gossamer women, whose body seemed spun from air. Her hair was light as straw, drawn back and middle-parted with wisps falling about her face. She patted the child's back. "Israel speaks highly of you. He says you've been kind enough to listen as he explained our faith. I hope he didn't tire you. He can be unrelenting." She smiled at me in a conspiratorial way. I didn't want her to be so pretty and charming.
Well, he was certainly thorough,
I said, and her laughter gurgled up. I looked at Israel. He was beaming at her.
"If you return to the north, you must come and stay with us," Rebecca said. Then she herded the children to their cabin.
Israel lingered a moment longer, pulling out John Woolman's journal.
"Please accept it."
"But it's your own copy. I couldn't possibly take it."
"It would please me greatly. I'll get another when I return to Philadelphia. I only ask that after you read it, you write to me of your impressions."
He opened the book and showed me a piece of paper on which he'd written his address. That night, after I blew out the wick, I lay awake, thinking of the book tucked in my trunk and the address secreted inside. "After you read it, write to me." The water moved beneath me, rushing toward Charleston into the swaying dark.
Handful. When they plan to sell you, the first thing they say is, "Go wash your teeth." That's what Aunt Sister always told us. She said when the slaves got sold on the streets, the white men checked their teeth before anything else. None of us were thinking about teeth after Master Grimke died, though. We thought life would go on in the same old grudgeries. The lawyer showed up to read the will 2 days after Sarah got back from the north. We gathered in the dining room, every one of the Grimke children and every slave. Seemed odd to me why Mrs. wanted us slaves here. We stood in a straight line in the back of the room, half thinking we're part of the family. Sarah was on one side of the table and Nina on the other. Sarah would look over at her sister with a sad smile, and Nina would glance away. Those two were in a miff. Mrs. had on her nice black mourning dress. I wanted to tell her she needed to take it off and let Mariah launder it because it had gray armpit rings. Seemed like she'd worn it every day since last August. But you couldn't tell her the thing. The woman got worse in her ways by the day. The lawyer, his name was Mr. Hughie, stood up with a handful of papers and said it was the last will and testament of John Forshero Grimke, drawn up last May. He read the wherefores, to wits, and hithermores. It was worse than the Bible. Mrs. didn't get the house. That went to Henry, who wasn't past 18, but at least she could stay in it till she died. I leave her the household furniture, plate, plated ware, a carriage, and two of my horses, the stock of liquors and provisions which shall be on hand at the time of my death. This went on and on, all the goods and chattels. Then he read something that made the hairs on my arms raise. "She shall receive any six of my Negroes whom she shall choose, and the rest she will sell or disperse among my children, as she determines." Bennett was standing next to me. I heard her whisper, "Lord, no." I looked down the row of slaves. There were just 11 of us now. Rosetta had passed on in her sleep the year before. "She shall receive any six. The rest she will sell or disperse." 5 of us were leaving. Minta started to sniffle. Aunt Sister said, "Hush up." But even her old eyes darted around looking scared. She trained Phoebe too good. Tomfrey was getting on with age, too, and Eli's fingers were twisted like tree twigs. Goodis and Sawby were still young, but you don't need two slaves in the stable for two horses. Prince was strong and worked the yard, but he had glum spells now, sitting and staring and blowing his nose on his shirt. Mariah was a good worker, and I figured she'd stay, but Benna, she moaned under her breath 'cause she was the nursery mama, and there were no more children to rear. I said to myself, Mrs. will need a seamstress. But then I noticed the black dress again. From here on out, all she'd need was a few of those to wear, and she could hire somebody for that. All of a sudden, Sarah said, Father couldn't have meant that. Mrs. shot her a look of venom. Your father wrote the words himself, and we'll honor his wishes. We have no choice. Please allow Mr. Hughie to continue. When he started back reading, Sarah looked at me with the same sorrowful blue eyes she'd had the day she turned 11 years old, and I was standing before her with the lavender ribbon round my neck. The world was abashed in place, and she couldn't fix it. In December, everybody was on their last nerve, waiting for the missus to say who'd go and who'd stay. If I was sold, how would Mama find me if she came back? Every night, I put a hot brick in my bed to keep my feet warm and lay there thinking how Mama was alive, out there somewhere. I wondered if the man who bought her was kind. I wondered if he'd put her in the fields. Was she doing any sewing? Did she have my little brother or sister with her? Was she still wearing the pouch round her neck? I knew she'd get back here if she could. This was where her spirit was, in the tree. This was where I was. Don't let me be the one that has to go. Mrs. didn't have Christmas that year, but she said go ahead and have junkanoo if you want to. That was a custom that got started a few years back brought by the Jamaica slaves. Tomfrey would dress up in a shirt and pants, tatted with strips of bright cloth sewed on, and a stovepipe hat on his head, what we call the rag man. We'd traipse behind him, singing and banging pots, winding to the back door. He'd knock and Mrs. and everybody would come out and watch him dance. Then Mrs. would hand out little gifts to us. Could be a coin or a new candle. Sometimes a scarf or a cob pipe. This was supposed to keep us happy. We didn't expect to feel in the mood this year, but on John Canoe Day, here came Tomfrey in the yard, wearing his shaggy outfit, and we made a lot of clatter and forgot our troubles for a minute. Mrs. stepped out from the back door in a black dress with a basket of gifts, Sarah, Nina, Henry, and Charles behind her. They were trying to smile at us. Even Henry, who took after his mama, looked like a grinning angel. Tomfrey did his jig, twirled, bounced, wagged his arms. The ribbons whirled out, and when he was done, they clapped. And he took off the tall hat and rubbed the crust of gray on his scalp. Reaching in the basket, Mrs. gave the women these nice fans made with painted paper. The men got two coins, not one. The sky had been cast down all day, but now the sun broke free. Mrs. leaned on her gold-tipped cane and squinted at us. She called out Tomfrey's name, then Benna, Eli, Prince, Mariah. She said, I have something extra for you, and handed each one a jar of gargling oil. You've served me well, she told them. Tomfrey, you will go to John's household. Benna, you will go to Thomas. Eli, I'm sending you to Mary. Then she turned to Prince and Mariah. I'm sorry to say you must be sold. It's not my wish, but it's necessary. Nobody spoke. The quiet sat on us like a stone you couldn't lift. Mariah dropped down and walked on her knees to Mrs., crying for her to change her mind. Mrs. wiped her eyes. Then she turned and went in the house, followed by her sons, but Sarah and Nina stayed behind, their faces full of pity. The axe didn't fall on me. Didn't my Lord deliver a handful? The axe didn't fall on Goodis either, and I felt surprise over the relief this caused me. But there was no God in any of it. Nothing but the four of them standing there, and Mariah still on her knees. I couldn't bear to look at Tomfrey, with the hat squashed under his arm, Prince and Eli studying the ground, Benna holding her paper fan, staring at Phoebe, a daughter she'd never see again. Mrs. doled out their jobs to the ones of us left. Sarby took over Tomfrey as the butler. Goodis had the work yard, the stable, and drove the carriage. Phoebe got the laundry, and Minta and I got Eli's cleaning duties. When the first of the year came, Mrs. sent me to work on the English chandelier in the drawing room. She said Eli hadn't shined it proper in 10 years. It had 28 arms with crystal shades and teardrops of cut glass hanging down. Using the ladder and wearing white cotton gloves, I took it apart and laid it out on the table and shined it with ammonia. Then I couldn't figure out how to put the thing back together. I found Sarah in her room, reading a leather book. "We'll figure it out," she said. We hadn't talked much since she got back. She seemed woebegone all the time, always stuck in that same book. After we finally got the chandelier back on the ceiling in one piece, tears flared up in her eyes. I said, "You sad about your daddy?" She answered me the strangest way, and I knew what she said was the real hurt she'd brought back with her. I'm 27 years old, handful, and this is my life now. She looked round the room, up at the chandelier, and back at me. This is my life, right here for the rest of my days. Her voice broke, and she covered her mouth with her hand. She was trapped same as me, but she was trapped by her mind, by the minds of the people around her, not by the law. At the African church, Mr. VC used to say, "Be careful. You can get enslaved twice, once in your body and once in your mind." I tried to tell her that. I said, "My body might be a slave, but not my mind. For you, it's the other way around." She blinked at me, and the tears came again, shining like cut glass. The day Benna left, I heard Phoebe crying all the way from the kitchen house.
Sarah. 1 February, 1820. Dear Israel, how often I have thought of our conversations on board ship. I read the book you entrusted to me, and my spirit was deeply kindled. There are so many things I wish to ask you. How I wish we were together again. 3 February, 1820. Dear Mr. Morris, after being away from the evils of slavery for 6 months, my mind burst with new horror at seeing it again on my return to Charleston. It was made all the worse upon reading the book you gave me. I have nowhere to turn but you. 10 February, 1820. Dear Mr. Morris, I trust you are well. How is your dear wife, Rebecca? 11 February, 1820. Thank you, sir, for the book. I find a bewildering beauty in your Quaker beliefs. The notion there is a seed of light inside of us, a mysterious inner voice. Would you kindly advise me how this voice... I wrote to him over and over. Letters I couldn't finish. Invariably I would stop mid-sentence. I would lay down the quill, fold the letter, and conceal it with the rest at the back of my desk drawer. It was the middle of the afternoon, the winter gloom hovering as I pulled out the thick bundle, untied the black satin ribbon, and added the letter of February 11 to the heap. Mailing the letters would only bring anguish. I was too drawn to him. Every letter he answered would incite my feelings more. And it would do no good to have him encouraging me toward Quakerdom. The Quakers were a despised sect here, regarded as anomalous, plain-dressed, and strange,
a tiny cluster of jarringly eccentric people who drew stares on the street. Surely I didn't need to invite that kind of ridicule and shun. And Mother, she would never allow it. Hearing her cane on the pine floor outside, I snatched up the letters and yanked open the drawer, my hands fumbling with panic. The stationery cascaded into my lap and onto the rug. As I stooped to collect it, the door swung open without a knock, and she stood framed in the opening, her eyes moving across my hidden cache. I looked up at her with the black ribbon furling from my fingers.
"You're needed in the library," she said.
I couldn't detect the slightest curiosity in her about the contents I had spilled.
"Sabe is packing your father's books. I need you to oversee that he does it properly."
"Packing?"
"They will be divided between Thomas and John," she said,
and turning, left me. I gathered up the letters, tied them with the ribbon, and slipped them back into the drawer. Why I kept them, I didn't know. It was foolish. When I arrived in the library, Sabi wasn't there. He'd emptied most of the shelves, stacking the books in several large trunks, which sat open on the floor, the same floor where I'd knelt all those years ago when Father forbade me the books. I didn't want to think of it, of that terrible time, of the room stripped now, the books lost to me, always lost. I sank into Father's chair. The clock in the main passage clicked, magnifying, and I felt the shadows gathering inside of me again. Worse this time. Since returning, I'd slipped further into melancholy each day. It was the same trough of darkness I'd fallen into when I was 12, and the life had gone out of everything. Mother had summoned Dr. Gettings back then, and I feared she might do so again. Every day I forced myself to come down for tea. I endured the visitations from her friends. I kept up my attendance at church, at Bible study, at alms meetings. I sat with Mother in the mornings, hoops of embroidery on our laps, willing the needle through the cloth. She'd given me the task of household records, and each week I sorted through the supplies, writing inventories and procurement lists. The house, the slaves, Charleston, Mother, the Presbyterians. They were the woof and warp of everything. Nina had pulled away. She was angry at me for remaining in Philadelphia after Father died.
"You don't know what it was like alone here," she'd cried. "Mother instructed me constantly in the error of my ways. Everything from church to slavery to my rebellious nature. It was horrible."
I'd been the buffer between her and Mother, and my remaining away for so long had left her exposed. "I'm sorry," I told her.
"You only wrote to me once."
Her beautiful face was contorted with hurt and resentment.
"Once."
It was true. I'd been so enamored with my freedom up there, I hadn't bothered. "I'm sorry," I said again. I knew in time she would forgive the selfish months I'd abandoned her, but I sensed the estrangement came from more than that. At 15, she'd needed to break away, to come out from my shadow, to understand who she was separate from me. My retreat to Philadelphia was only the excuse she needed to declare her independence. As she fled to her room the day of our confrontation, she shouted,
"Mother was right. I have no mind of my own, only yours."
We passed now like strangers. I let her be, but it added to my despair. I stared at the trunks of books on the library floor, remembering the pangs I'd once had for a profession, for some purpose. The world had been such a beckoning place once. Sabi still had not returned. I got up from my chair and rummaged nostalgically among the books, coming upon The Sacred Biography of Jeanne d'Arc of France. I couldn't say how many times I'd read that wondrous little volume of St. Joan's bravery before Father had banned me from his library. Opening it now, I gazed at a sketch of her coat of arms. Two fleurs-de-lis. I'd forgotten it was there. And it made sudden sense to me why I'd latched on to the fleur-de-lis button when I was 11. I slipped the book beneath my shawl. That night, unable to sleep, I heard the clock downstairs bong 2, then 3. The rain began soon after, beating without mercy against the piazza and the windows. I climbed from the covers and lit the lantern. I would write to Israel. I would tell him how melancholy swallowed me at times, how I almost felt the grave would be a refuge. I would write yet another letter I wouldn't mail. Perhaps it would relieve me. I pulled open the desk drawer and watched the light tumble inside it. There, as I'd left it, was my Bible and my Blackstone commentary, my stationery, ink, pen, ruler, and sealing wax. Yet I didn't see the bundle of letters. I drew the lamp closer and reached my hand into the empty corners. The black ribbon was there, curled like a malicious afterthought. My letters to Israel were gone. I wanted to scream at her. The need took hold of me with blinding violence, and I flung open my door and rushed down the stairs, clinging to the rail as my feet seemed to sweep out from under me. I battered her door with my fist, then rattled the knob. It was locked.
How dare you take them? I shrieked. How dare you? Open the door! Open it!
I couldn't imagine what she thought on reading my intimate implorings to a stranger in the north. A Quaker? A man with a wife? Did she think I'd remained in Philadelphia for him? Behind the door, I heard her call to Minta, who slept on the floor near her bed. I pounded again.
Open it! You had no right!
She didn't respond, but Nina's scared voice came from the stair landing. Sister? Looking up, I saw her white gown glowing in the dark. Henry and Charles beside her, the three of them like wraiths.
Go to bed, I said.
Their bare feet slapped the floor and I heard the doors to their rooms bang shut one by one. Turning back, I lifted my fist again, but my rage had begun to recede, flowing back into the terrible place it had come from. Limp and exhausted, I leaned my head against the door sill. Hating myself. The next morning, I couldn't get out of bed. I tried very hard, but it was as if something in me had dropped anchor. I rolled my face into the pillow. I no longer cared. During the days that followed, Handful brought me trays of food, which I barely touched. I had no hunger for anything except sleep, and it eluded me. Some nights I wandered onto the piazza and stared over the rail at the garden, imagining myself falling. Handful placed a gunny sack beside me on the bed one day.
"Open it up," she said.
When I did, the smell of char wafted out. Inside, I found my letters, singed and blackened. She'd found Minta tossing them into the fire in the kitchen house, as Mother had ordered. Handful had rescued them with a poker. When spring came and my state of mind didn't improve, Dr. Gettings arrived. Mother seemed genuinely afraid for me. She visited my room with handfuls of drooping jonquils and spoke sweetly, saying I should come for a stroll with her on Gadsden Green, or that she'd asked Aunt Sister to bake me a rice pudding. She brought me notes of concern from members of my church, who were under the impression I had pleurisy. I would gaze at her blankly, then look away toward the window. Nina visited, too.
"Was it me?" she asked. "Did I cause you to feel like this?"
"Oh, Nina," I said.
You must never think that. I can't explain what's wrong with me, but it's not you."
Then one day in May, Thomas appeared.
He insisted we sit on the porch where the air was warm and weighed with the scent of lilacs. I listened as he went on heatedly about a recent compromise in Congress that had undone the ban on slavery in Missouri.
"That damnable Henry Clay," he said. "The great pacificator. He has started the cancer spreading again."
I had no idea what he was talking about. To my surprise, though, I felt curious. Later, I would realize that was Thomas's intention, creating a little pulley to try and tow me back.
"He's a fool. He believes letting slavery into Missouri will placate the firebrands down here, but it's only splitting the country further."
He reached for the newspaper he'd brought and spread it out for me.
"Look at this."
A letter had been printed on the front page of the Mercury, which called Clay's compromise a fire bell in the night. "It has awakened and filled me with terror. I consider it the knell of the Union." The letter was signed Thomas Jefferson. It had been so long since I'd cared what was happening out there. Some old wrath sparked in me. Hostility toward slavery must be finding some bold new footing. Why, it sounded as if my brother himself was hostile to it.
"You are sided with the North?"
I asked.
"I only know we can't go on blind to the sin of putting people in chains. It must come to an end."
"Are you freeing your slaves then, Thomas?" Asking it was vindictive. I knew he had no such intention.
"While you were away, I founded an American colonization chapter here in Charleston. We're raising money."
"Please tell me you're not still hoping to buy up all the slaves and send them back to Africa." I hadn't felt such fervor since my discussions with Israel during the voyage. My cheeks burned with it.
"That is your answer to the spreading cancer?" "It may be a poor answer, Sarah, but I can imagine no other."
"Must our imaginations be so feeble as that, Thomas? If the Union dies, as our president says, it will be from lack of imagination. It will be from southern hubris and our love of wealth and the brutality of our hearts." He stood and looked down at me. He smiled.
"There she is," he said. "There's my sister."
I cannot say I became my old self after that, but the melancholy gradually lifted, replaced with the jittery feeling of emerging, like a creature without a skin or a shell. I began to eat the rice puddings. I sipped tea steeped in St. John's wort and sat in the sun and reread the Quaker book. I thought often of the fire bell in the night. At midsummer, without any forethought, I took out a sheet of stationery. 19 July, 1820. "Dear Mr. Morris, forgive my long delay in writing to you. The book you gave me last November aboard ship has been my faithful companion for all this time. The Quaker beliefs beckon to me, but I do not know if I have the courage to follow them. There would be a great and dreadful cost. Of that I am certain. I ask nothing except your counsel. Yours most truly, Sarah Grimke." I gave the letter to Handful. "Guard it carefully," I told her. "Post it yourself in the afternoon mail." When Israel's letter arrived in return, I was in the warming kitchen, surveying the pantries and writing a list of foods needed at the market. Handful had waylaid it from Sabi when it arrived at the door. She handed it to me and waited. I took a butter knife from the drawer and ripped the seal. I read it twice, once to myself, then aloud to her. 10 September, 1820. "Dear Miss Grimke, I was gratified to receive your letter, and most especially to learn that you are swayed to the Quakers. God's way is narrow, and the cost is great. I remind you of the scripture, 'He that finds his life shall lose it,
and he that loses his life shall find it. Do not fear to lose what needs to be lost. I regret to say I have grave and sorrowful news to impart. My dear Rebecca passed away last January. She died of a malignant influenza soon after our return to Philadelphia. My sister, Catherine, has come to care for the children. They miss their mother, as do I. But we are comforted that our beloved wife and mother is with God. Write to me. I am here to encourage you in your path. Your friend, Israel Morris. I sat in my room at midday, with my eyes closed and my fingers laced in my lap, listening for the voice the Quaker seemed so sure was inside of us. I'd been indulging in this dubious activity since receiving Israel's letter, though I doubted the Quakers would have called it an activity. For them, this listening was the ultimate inactivity, a kind of capitulation to the stillness of one's private heart. I wanted to believe God would eventually show up, murmuring little commands and illuminations. As usual, I heard nothing. I'd responded to Israel's letter immediately, my hand shaking so badly the ink lines had appeared rickety on the paper. I'd poured out my sympathy, my prayers, all sorts of pious assurances. Every word seemed trite, like the prattle that went on at my Bible studies. I felt protected behind it. He'd responded with another letter, and our correspondence had finally begun, consisting mostly of earnest inquiries on my part and bits of guidance on his. I asked him pointedly what the inner voice sounded like. How will I recognize it? "I cannot tell you," he wrote, "but when you hear it, you will know." That day the silence felt unusually dull and heavy, like the weight of water. It clogged my ears and throbbed against my drums. Fidgety thoughts darted through my mind, reminding me of squirrels loose in their trees. Perhaps I was too Anglican, too Presbyterian, too Grimke for this. I lifted my eyes to the fireplace and saw the coals had gone out. "Just a few more minutes," I told myself, and when my lids sank closed again, I had no expectations, no hope, no endeavoring. I'd given up on the voice. And it was then my mind stopped racing, and I began to float on some quiet stream. "Go north." The voice broke into my small oblivion, dropping like a dark, beautiful stone. I caught my breath. It was not like a common thought. It was distinct, shimmering, and dense with God. "Go north." I opened my eyes. My heart leapt so wildly I placed a hand across my breast and pressed. It was unthinkable. Unmarried daughters didn't go off to live unprotected on their own in a foreign place. They lived at home with their mothers, and when there was no mother, with their sisters, and when there were no sisters, with their brothers. They didn't break with everything and everyone they knew and loved. They didn't throw over their lives and their reputations and their family name. They didn't create scandals. I rose to my feet and paced before the window, saying to myself it wasn't possible. Mother would rain down Armageddon. Voice or no voice, she would put a swift end to it. Father had left all his properties and the vast share of his wealth to his sons, but he hadn't forgotten his daughters. He'd left us each $10,000, and if I were frugal, if I lived on the interest, it would provide for me the rest of my life. Beyond the window, the sky loomed large, filled with broken light, and I remembered suddenly that day last winter in the drawing room when Handful cleaned the chandelier, the allegation she'd leveled at me. "My body might be a slave, but not my mind. For you, it's the other way round." I dismissed the words. What could she know of it? But I saw now how exact they were. My mind had been shackled.
I strode to my dresser and opened the drawer of my Hepplewhite, the one I never opened, the one that held the lava box. Inside it, I found the silver button Handful had returned to me some years ago. It was black with tarnish and long forgotten. I took it in my palm. How does one know the voice is God's? I believed the voice bidding me to go north belonged to him, though perhaps what I really heard that day was my own impulse to freedom. Perhaps it was my own voice. Does it matter? Part 4. September 1821 through July 1822. Sarah. The house was named Green Hill. When Israel wrote, inviting me to stay with his family in the countryside of Philadelphia, I'd imagined an airy, white-frame house with a big veranda and shutters the color of pine. It was a shock to arrive at the end of spring and find a small castle made entirely of stone. Green Hill was a megalithic arrangement of pale gray rocks, arched windows, balconies, and turrets. Gazing up at it for the first time, I felt like a proper exile. Israel's late wife, Rebecca, had at least made the inside of the house soft. She'd filled it with hooked rugs and floral pillows, with simple shaker furniture and wall clocks from which little birds popped out all day and cuckooed the hour. It was a very odd place, but I came to like living inside a quarry. I liked the way the stone facade glistened in the rain and silvered over when the moon was full. I liked how the children's voices echoed in slow spirals through the rooms, and how the air stayed dim and cool in the heat of the day. Mostly I liked how impenetrable it felt. I took up residence in a garret room on the third floor, following months of correspondence with Israel and endless skirmishes with Mother. My tactic had been to convince her the whole thing was God's idea. She was a devout woman. If anything could trump her social obsessions, it was piety. But when I told her about the inner voice, she was horrified. In her mind, I'd gone the way of the lunatic female saints who'd gotten themselves boiled in oil and burned at the stake. When I finally confessed I meant to live under the roof of the man I'd written those scandalous, unsent letters to, she broke out in symptoms, cold sores to chest pain. The chest pains were real enough, as evidenced by her drawn, perspiring face, and I worried my intentions might literally kill her. "If there's a shred of decency in you, you will not run off to live in the house of a Quaker widower," she'd shouted during our final clash. We were in her bedchamber at the time, and I stood with my back to the window, looking at her face streaked with anger. "Israel's unmarried sister lives there, too," I told her for the 10th time. "I'm simply renting a room. I'll help with the children. I'm to be in charge of the girls' lessons. It's all very respectable. Think of me as a tutor." "A tutor." She pressed the back of her hand to her forehead as if warding off some heavenly debris. "This would kill your father, if he weren't already dead." "Don't bring father into this. He would want me to be happy." "I cannot. I will not bless this." Then I'll go without your blessing." I was dazed at my boldness. She drew back in the chair, and I knew I'd stung her. She glared at me with taut, blistering eyes. "Then go. But keep this sordid business of hearing voices to yourself. You're going north for your health. Do you understand?" "And what exactly is my affliction?" She looked toward the window and seemed to survey a piece of the saffron sky. Her silence went on for so long, I wondered if I'd been dismissed. "Coughing," she said. "We fear you have consumption." That was the pact I made. Mother would tolerate my sojourn and refrain from severing me from the family, and I would pretend my lungs were threatened with consumption. During the 3 months I'd been at Green Hill, I'd often felt dislocated and homesick. I missed Nina, and Handful was always at the edges of my mind. To my surprise, I missed Charleston, certainly not its slavery or its social castes, but the wash of light on the harbor, the salt brining the air, birds of paradise in the gardens with their orange heads raised, summer winds flapping the hurricane shutters on the piazzas. When I closed my eyes, I heard the bells on St. Philip's and sniffed the choking sweetness of the privet hedge that fell over the city. Mercifully, the days here had been busy. They were filled with 8 forlorn children, ranging from 5 years all the way to 16, and the domestic chores I undertook for Israel's sister, Catherine. Even in my most severe Presbyterian moments, I'd been no match for her. She was a well-meaning woman, afflicted with an incurable primness. Despite her spectacles, she had weak, watery eyes that couldn't see enough to thread a needle or measure flour. I didn't know how they'd managed before me. The girls' dresses were unevenly hemmed, and we were as apt to get salt in the sponge cake as sugar. There were long weekly rides to the Arch Street meeting house in town, where I was now a Quaker probationer, having endured the interrogation from the Council of Elders about my convictions. I had only to wait now for their decision and be on my best behavior. Every evening, to Catherine's immense displeasure, Israel and I walked down the hill to the little pond to feed the ducks. Decked in green iridescent feathers and fancy black hoods, they were the most un-Quaker of ducks. Catherine had once compared their plumage to my dresses. "Do all Southern ladies adorn themselves in this ostentatious manner?" she'd asked. If the woman only knew. I'd left the most grandiose of my wardrobe behind. I'd given Nina a number of silk frocks adorned with everything from feathers to fur, a lavish lace headdress, an imported Van Dyked cap, a shawl of flounced tulle, a lapis brooch, strands of pearls, a fan inlaid with tiny mirrors. At some point, I would have to untrim my bonnet. I would have to go through the formal divestment, getting rid of all my lovely things and resorting to gray dresses and bare bonnets, which would make me appear plainer than I already was. Catherine had already presented several of these mousy outfits to me as encouragement, as if the sight of them encouraged anything but aversion. Fortunately, the untrimming ritual wasn't required until my probation ended, and I had no intention of hurrying it. When Israel and I visited the pond, we tossed crusts of bread on the water and watched the ducks paddle after them. There was a weathered rowboat turned upside down in the cattails on the far side, but we never ventured into it. We sat instead on a bench he'd built himself, and conversed about the children, politics, God, and inevitably the Quaker faith. He spoke a great deal about his wife, who'd been gone a year and a half. She could have been canonized, his Rebecca. Once, after speaking of her, his voice choked, and he held my hand as we lingered silently in the deepening violet light. In September, before summer left us, I was fathoms deep on the mattress in my room when the sound of crying broke into my slumber and I came swimming up from a dark blue sleep. The window was hinged open, and for a moment I heard nothing but the crickets in their percussion. Then it came again, a kind of whimpering. I cracked the door to find Becky, Israel's 6-year-old, swallowed in an oversized white gown, blubbering and rubbing her eyes. She not only had her mother's name, but her wilted flaxen hair. And yet in some ways the child reminded me of myself. She had brows and lashes so light they were barely visible, giving her the same whitewashed look I wore. More than that, she chewed and mumbled her words, for which her siblings teased her unmercifully. Overhearing one of her brothers call her Mealy Mouth, I'd given him a talking to. He avoided me nowadays, but Becky had followed me about ever since like a bear cub. She rushed at me now, throwing herself into my arms.
My goodness, what's all this?
I dreamed about Mama. She was in a box in the ground.
Oh, sweet one, no. Your mother's with God and his angels.